is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation says there is no indication the gunman who killed 49 people and wounded dozens at an Orlando nightclub Sunday morning was directed from outside the U.S. or part of an Islamist network. James Comey said investigators are confident Omar Mateen was inspired by jihadis and radicalized online.
There are strong indications of radicalization by this killer and of potential inspiration by foreign terrorist organizations. We are spending a tremendous amount of time, as you would imagine, trying to understand every moment of this killer's path to that terrible night in Orlando, to understand his motives and to understand the details of his life.
The 29-year-old son of Afghan immigrants was shot and killed by police after a three-hour standoff. President Obama will visit Orlando Thursday. The shooting has affected U.S. presidential politics, with presumptive Republican Party candidate Donald Trump proposing a suspension of immigration from countries with a proven record of terrorism.
And although the pause is temporary, we must find out what is going on. We have to do it.
His likely Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton, said while Mateen is dead, the virus that poisoned his mind lives on.
And we must attack it with clear eyes, steady hands, unwavering determination, and pride in our country and our values.
However, she warned against demonizing all Muslims. The governments of Eritrea and Ethiopia traded accusations Monday, accusing each other of starting border clashes, a fresh reminder of an unresolved boundary dispute that triggered conflict more than a decade ago. An Ethiopian government spokesman said there were significant casualties on both sides in the incident Sunday. Calm was reported restored Monday. Eritrea won independence from Ethiopia in 1991. This is VOA News. A Syrian rights group said an Islamic State counterattack on advancing Syrian government forces near the IS-held Tabqa airport left nearly 30 fighters on both sides dead. Tabqa lies about 50 kilometers east of the U.S. de facto capital, Raqqa. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke again by phone Monday with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, about the tattered cessation of hostilities. Mark Toner is a U.S. spokesman.
And the fact that it continues to be violated in multiple places around Aleppo, Deraa, and Latakia, and the fact that we still contend, and we have seen that the vast majority of these violations are being committed by the regime.
Toner said while Syria is going after terror groups like Nusra, not covered by the cessation, they are also attacking groups protected by it, including in regions near the city Aleppo. Britain's Labour Party and a former Prime Minister are coming out for staying within the European Union ahead of next week's referendum on whether to leave or remain. New polls suggest growing support for the Leave campaign ahead of the June 23rd ballot. Gordon Brown argues that close cooperation with Britain's neighbours is vital in dealing with the problem of extremism.
Terrorism is now a cross-border operation. And if you're going to deal with a cross-border operation, you need cross-border coordination. And you cannot solve the problem of tackling both terrorism and the causes of terrorism unless you're prepared to act with your neighbors.
World stocks have been slipping after several recent polls suggest the Leave campaign could prevail. Meanwhile, one of Britain's papers, The Sun, Monday came out endorsing the Leave campaign. In Turkey Monday, another car bombing in a town in the country's mainly Kurdish southeast wounded at least 9 people. The blast occurred near a housing block for civil servants working at a local courthouse. No immediate claim of responsibility. A curfew has been declared along the Pakistan-Afghan border following clashes at a border crossing that killed an Afghan guard and wounded several other people, including civilians. Both sides blamed the other for the incident. A ceasefire has been arranged. Pakistani fencing at the border to control the infiltration of Afghan militants has been opposed by Kabul. At least one soldier was killed, several security force personnel wounded, when an attack on a police post in northern Uganda was repelled. Sunday's attack comes amid lingering political tensions following the February re-election of longtime President Yoweri Museveni. Opposition leader Kizza Besigye claimed victory and has been charged with treason. The military has also detained dozens of soldiers and officers under suspicion of subversion. Scientists at the U.S. Space Agency NASA and San Diego State University discovered the largest planet outside our solar system that orbits 2 suns. The team made the discovery using the Kepler Space Telescope. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 14th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zanzibar's former opposition presidential candidate has a prescription how to strengthen multi-party democracy in Africa.
We have to build up very strong opposition parties to take as many people as possible into the opposition and weaken the ruling parties.
Seif Sharif Hamad is leader of Zanzibar's opposition Civic United Front Party. Gambia's president is condemned again, this time for his remark to eliminate the Mandinka ethnic group. A top UN official says South Sudan's transitional government should move quickly to implement the peace deal. And a motion is expected today to be tabled to expand President Museveni's cabinet.
Apart from the car that you are given as a member of cabinet, the difference in salary is almost nothing. So it doesn't really add a lot of benefits in terms of cash.
Margaret Muhanga is a member of parliament from Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement. The news tightens around fugitive war criminals residing in the United States and elsewhere and getting buried in style in Ghana. Those stories plus Marco Uman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The leader of Zanzibar's opposition Civic United Front, CUF party, says strong opposition political parties and truly independent electoral commissions are needed to be able to defeat incumbent presidents in Africa. Seif Sharif Hamad also says Africans must ensure that the army and all other security forces are kept out of politics because too often they tend to support the ruling party. In March this year, Zanzibar held a rerun of its October 2015 election, but the CUF boycotted the rerun because it believed its candidate, Hamad, won the October 25th election. Mr. Hamad is currently visiting Washington, D.C. to explain to U.S. officials about the political situation in Zanzibar. He stopped by our VOA studio yesterday and told me he boycotted the March 20th rerun presidential election because it was illegal.
First of all, the chairman of Zanzibar Electoral Commission had no power to nullify the election of October last year. So the results of last October last year, still they are very, very legitimate results, really. Secondly, you find in the constitution of Zanzibar and in the electoral law of Zanzibar, there is no section which says that there can be a rerun or another election on the other elections. So all these steps were very much illegal steps, really.
What would you like to say, a country like the United States and other international organizations?
In fact, you find the international community don't support us, but supported the democratical development of the country, really. And they were convinced that the steps taken by Chama Pinduzi were steps that were undemocratic. That is why they said that they would not support such a process. If there is a process which is very open and democratic, they will support that process. So now you find, you know, when you have such problems, you have to meet these people who matter from time to time, to remind them that the problem still is there and they could use their leverage to see to it that we get an amicable solution to the problem.
But it can be argued that by you not taking part in the rerun, you allowed the Chama Mapinduzi party to win. You didn't take part in the rerun.
Yes, we didn't take part because we knew that, first of all, it was illegal. We did not want to participate in illegal process. It's a matter of principle. But secondly, even if we participated, CCM nullified the elections and called new elections not to be defeated again. They had all arrangements in place to ensure that they would win.
Democracy in Africa, the opposition in Africa, what do you think? Do you think the opposition stands a chance each time there's election in Africa?
Well, you find it's true that the ruling parties don't want to lose power. That is a fact. So what we need is that we have to build up very strong opposition parties to take as many people as possible into the opposition and weaken the ruling parties. But also we have to ensure that the armed forces, they are kept away from politics, because most of these ruling parties are supported by the military, the police, and the intelligence services.
Saif Sharif Hamad is leader of Zanzibar's opposition Civic United Front Party. You are speaking with me in our Washington studio. Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement, the NRM, plans to officially table a motion in Parliament today, Tuesday, seeking to expand President Yoweri Museveni's cabinet from 81 to 88 members. But some parliamentarians from the government, the governing NRM, have kicked against the composition of the new cabinet, saying they are displeased with President Museveni's decision to also bring members of the opposition into his parliament. Margaret Muhanga, a ruling party parliamentarian, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the proposed cabinet fails to reflect regional, ethnic, and religious balance, which she said has been the normal practice over the years.
My concerns were that he picked so many ex-official members of parliament, ex-officials, okay, people outside elected leaders, and the number is quite high. That is one. The cabinet did not reflect regional balance. Religion balance, because here in Uganda, you see everything you have to balance. You pick from every region, every religion. And it wasn't well balanced. That's why I protested. So many members from the opposition in one district, in a whole region, leaving out the cadres of NRM.
But isn't the prerogative of the president to select the best people that he thinks he can work with, whether they are from opposition or the NRM, to work with?
His prerogative. We even said so. We said it is your prerogative, Your Excellency. But at the same time, you send these names to Parliament to vet. So if it was entirely his prerogative, then he wouldn't be seeking the approval of Parliament. He would simply appoint and life goes on. But as long as he comes back to Parliament to ask if these people are competent, if these people will reflect a national character, that is why he comes back to Parliament. So at that point, we have a stake. We say, please, here it doesn't reflect national character. If you pick from the opposition in this region, then also pick some NRM cadres, because it gives a bad impression that people have been in your party for a very long time, and in their whole region you are picking only opposition. People have just joined you. That does not show consistency, and as party members we got concerned.
What is wrong with President Museveni picking ex-official members to work with to seek approval from Parliament? What is wrong with that? And the Ugandans?
There is really nothing wrong with it. One of the reasons why members now, the ones who protested that particular issue, were arguing that these are the very people they defeated in constituencies. And now the same people are coming to cabinet. You know, cabinet, they will have more resources than mere members of Parliament. And they'll use the same resources to go back and decampaign them in the constituencies, and in the next election, take over the constituency. So if I have defeated somebody, that's what the issues were. If I have defeated somebody, you can appoint him elsewhere instead of bringing him in the very house where I am working, and then it builds bad blood. That is what they were arguing about.
Concerns have been raised about the expansion of cabinet from 81 to 88. Some people are saying it is too expensive and that is a drain on the national budget and also a drain on the taxpayer. What do you say to that?
Even if they argue that the cabinet is bloated, there is no member of cabinet who earns a salary outside what parliament pays. So if you are a member of parliament, you are going to get the same salary as the member of cabinet. Apart from the car that you are given, as a member of cabinet, the difference in salary is almost nothing. So it doesn't really add a lot of benefits in terms of cash.
Margaret Muhanga is a parliamentarian from Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. United Nations officials and human rights experts are condemning Gambian President Yahya Jammeh's remarks at a recent political rally when he threatened to eliminate the Madinka ethnic group. According to the United Nations Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, Jammeh referred to the Madinka as enemies and foreigners. and threatened to kill them one by one and place them where even fly cannot see them. Human Rights Watch's West Africa researcher James Warmington talks to Ricky Stryak about Mr. Jammeh's latest threat.
Jammeh is reported to have said, to refer to the Mandinka, which is the largest ethnic group in the Gambia, as enemies and foreigners, and has threatened to kill them and one by one and place them where even a fly cannot see them.
Jammeh says a lot of things, but how serious is the international community taking this? How serious should Gambians take this?
The international community has clearly taken them somewhat seriously, and Adama Dieng, the United Nations Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, came out and said he was profoundly alarmed by the remarks and that these types of statements can incite violence against communities, which is undoubtedly true.
He's been getting more and more outspoken, I feel like, telling the UN to, quote, go to hell, things like that.
Exactly. So, I mean, for example, these remarks were in reference to protests that had been led by the opposition in April, that had been one of the few protests calling for electoral reform and just kind of freeing up the political space in the Gambia. And I think what Jammeh is trying to do is sort of distract from the fact that there is beginning to be an open opposition movement in favor of democratic change, and kind of portray that movement as ethnic rather than what I think it is, which is a true desire and push within parts of Gambian society for more political freedoms. So I think that it's possible to kind of connect those remarks to remarks that he's also made around the recent death and detention of Solo Sandeng, who's a Gambian opposition leader, where he said, you know, look, I don't see the point in this death. People die in custody all the time. It's really common. So he's trying to sort of both underplay and downplay the events and the level of opposition against him, and also kind of distract people by trying to spread and paint them with an ethnic lens.
And as I understand it, another element of this that might be concerning is that Jammeh's government already, right now, he is from the Jola group, and a lot of people in power within his government are also Jola.
Certainly, there is the perception amongst other groups that Jammeh has favored the Jola ethnic group. What's important to connect this to is kind of the way in which Jammeh's rhetoric has been followed up on in the past. I mean, so he controls undoubtedly the entire security apparatus of the Gambia, and if he wants something to be done, it is done.
That was Jim Warmington, a West Africa researcher with Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington. It is becoming harder these days for war criminals to avoid justice. As VOA's Jeffrey Young reports, high-tech police organizations and tougher international legal systems are helping to track down and prosecute those suspected of crimes against humanity.
In country after country, the question of justice is coming to the fore as the bones of victims are unearthed. In courtrooms in Africa, The Hague, the United States, and elsewhere, accused war criminals and mass murderers are being prosecuted. On May 30, former Chadian President Hissine Habre was sentenced to life in prison by the extraordinary African Chambers and Senegal Tribunal set up by the African Union. This was the first time that a former national leader was prosecuted and convicted for human rights violations by the courts of another country. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Ziad Raad al-Hussein, noted the precedent set by Habre's conviction, saying that in a world scarred by a constant stream of atrocities, the ramifications of this verdict are global. The former Chadian president, however, disputes the conviction. He argues that the verdict of the Senegal-based African Chambers Court was invalid. Habre's attorney, Francois Serre, explained his position in an exclusive VOA Skype interview.
Mr. Habre was already tried in 2000 in Senegal. So our position from the beginning was the issue of double jeopardy. He could not be retried because specifically of a political decision of the president of Senegal, who was not happy by the Supreme Court decision of Senegal, saying that Mr. Habre should not be tried.
The Habre trial was held in Senegal partly because African leaders have long objected to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. They say the ICC unfairly targets Africans. While the U.S. Senate has not ratified the treaty that established the ICC, Washington does support the efforts of that court, according to George Washington University international law professor Ralph Steinhardt.
There has been a certain amount of informal cooperation between the United States government and the body that oversees the development and the operation of the International Criminal Court.
The United States also has its own laws on the subject, including the Alien Tort Statute, which gives the federal courts authority to try cases involving injuries to foreign nationals that occur overseas. Another law that pertains specifically to torture victims is currently being used in a Washington-area federal civil case against a former Somali military commander now living in the United States. Yusuf Abdi Ali is accused of war crimes during the Mohamed Siad Barre regime. The lead counsel in the case, Kathy Roberts, says this case, which may go to the U.S. Supreme Court, makes it clear that while alleged perpetrators can move across borders, the victims of their crimes have a right to justice regardless of where they are. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
A top UN official says South Sudan's transitional government of national unity should move quickly to implement the peace deal in order to improve the lives of ordinary citizens. The Undersecretary General for the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations, Hervé Lassus, spoke to reporters in Juba on Monday as he wrapped a three-day visit to South Sudan to assess conditions on the ground following the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity. Wake Simon will do reports for VOA from Juba.
Latsius says citizens are still not feeling the dividends of the peace agreement signed by the warring parties last August. He says the presence of the internally displaced persons or IDPs in various camps around the country is a clear sign that the transitional government should be moving more quickly to implement the terms of the peace deal.
When you look at South Sudan, one is struck by the fact that it has what not every country has, you know. It has fertile land on a very large scale. It has huge amounts of water and sunshine, so the agricultural, the agro-pastoral potential is huge. And then there is oil. So I think in the long term, there are reasons for optimism. But the first thing, of course, is to create stability that is conducive to resumption of more normal economic activity.
Latsius traveled to Bentiu and Malakal. He also met with President Salva Kiir, First Vice President Riek Machar, and other government officials. He says forming the transitional government of national unity in April opened a new chapter in South Sudanese affairs and the country's relations with the United Nations. But he says the government must prioritize stabilization of the economy and the restoration of peace and stability should take precedence before anything else.
We want to see the country moving ahead, addressing all those critical problems that it has been facing, so that as quickly as possible, through rapid implementation of the decisions that were already taken, people get a sense that the peace agreement is providing them with peace dividends.
Latsius says he is deeply concerned that ceasefire arrangements are still being violated across many parts in the country. But Latsius welcomed the return of stability to some areas like in Bentiu, where he says some 25,000 IDPs who had been sheltering in a UN camp have returned to their homes over the last 4 months. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A coffin in the shape of fish, guitar, or a fancy sport car. In Ghana, you can choose to be buried in style. Inspired by the traditional palanquin, figurative coffins have been in vogue in the country since the mid-1950s, and some are now even considered pieces of art exhibited in museums around the world and worth several thousand dollars. Emily Yap reports for VOA from Accra.
In his small workshop outside the capital, Accra, coffin maker Sedi Kway is working on his latest creation.
It's a string. It takes me about 2 weeks. It's a market 2 months.
Okay.
Two size string, yeah.
This is just one of the many figurative coffins that the little shop has become famous for in the past few decades, since Kway's father got the idea to build an airplane-shaped coffin for his late mother, who always wanted to fly in one. He was inspired by the traditional palanquin used to carry important people. The design often reflects the profession or the character of the deceased, a bullet for a soldier, a church for a clergyman, or a tiger to symbolize strength. The prices depend on the design and type of wood. But in Ghana, families typically spare no expense for funerals.
We believe in our ancestors, you know,
when the person was alive and he says something, you need to do it.
Figurative coffins are by no means the norm in Ghana, but Kwai says the market is doing well. He produces about 10 coffins per month with his 7 apprentices.
I think their business is now going up and up. It's now spreading all the world. Last year we did an organ for a musician and another one spanner for mechanic. We send it to Britain.
And there are also a more recent kind of buyers, art collectors and galleries. This bulb-shaped coffin, exhibited in a famous gallery in Abidjan, is the creation of Kwai's cousin, Joseph Ashong, also known as Pajo. Over the years, he has sold coffins to galleries in the Netherlands, in the US and in the UK. A few years ago, a Porsche-shaped coffin he made sold for $9,000. His international customers make up for about one quarter of his sales. Today, he's working with his son on a tortoise-shaped palanquin for a local chief.
The price?
Yes.
It's a very big price.
It'll take the man 2 weeks to make it. Pajo, likewise, works without blueprints. Soon, his son Jacob is meant to take over the family business. Emilia for VOA News in Accra.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Woman in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Swaziland outclassed Seychelles 4-0 as Madagascar and Zimbabwe played to a scoreless draw in a Group A action at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Windhoek, Namibia on Monday. Consequently, Swaziland and Madagascar have 4 points each. However, Swaziland leads Group A courtesy of a superior goal average. Zimbabwe is third with 2 points while Seychelles have no point. Today, Tuesday, attention shifts to Group B, where the youthful Angolan side challenge Lesotho before Mauritius encounter Malawi. Elsewhere, hosts Ghana overpowered Ethiopia 4-0 in the return leg of the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifier in Cape Coast on Monday. The match was postponed for a day owing to heavy rain. Ghana prevailed 5-2 on aggregate to advance to the third round of the qualifiers. In Morocco, Gambia required a sudden death penalty shootout to squeeze 7-6 past hosts Morocco in the return leg of their 2017 Africa Under-20 Championship qualifier in Rabat. Morocco led 1-0 at the end of open play, resulting in a 1-1 deadlock on aggregate. Turning to athletics, Kenya is on track with its preparations to host the 2017 World Youth Athletics Championships. The IAAF Head of Events Operations, Carlos Diangeli, declared in Nairobi on Monday. Diangeli led an IAAF inspection team to assess the facilities designated for use during the championship. Nairobi's Kasarani Stadium, which was the main venue for the 1987 All-Africa Games, is set to be the venue for the event, while the nearby Kenya University campus will be the athletes' village. Diangeli pointed out that Kasarani Stadium track and the adjacent warm-up area require a new tartan surface. Kenya is set to host the global event next year in July. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Eritrean Ministry of Information issued a statement this Sunday accusing the Ethiopian government of launching a military attack against the country. Ethiopia denies initiating the attack. And that is it for this Tuesday, June 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.